Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us today. On our way to our conversation, let's look at this day in history on September the 25th. There's a man whose name was Lewis Hine that some of you may know, some may not know, but you may have seen his photographs. He was one of the most amazing photographers in the history of early American photography. 1874, he was born on this day in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and he photographed social commentary around poverty, children, child labor, what American capitalism has done to the poor of this country that really grabbed this nation in the early 20th century. He himself died in poverty. He was one of the most amazing photographers ever, and we will link to some of his work on our website. This is the day in 1897 that William Faulkner was born, of course, the great American author, and this is the day that Mark Rothko, the great abstract painter, was born in 1903, a play coming up about him at Everyman Theater in the next month. This is the day in 1915, Ethel Rosenberg, accused of spying for the Soviet Union, was born in 1915. And in 1929, Barbara Walters was born on this day, as well as Glenn Gould. We'll be hearing from one of the great pianists of all time, a Canadian pianist, born in 1932. This is a day that Cecil Womack, and we will be hearing his music today, was born in 1947, passed away much too early in 2013. Wrote some of the great songs for Chess Records, Soul and R&B pieces. We'll be hearing some of his music during the breaks. This is the day that Will Smith, the actor, was born in 1968. And in 1980, the rapper T.I. was born. That's on this day, in September 25th. And dying on this day, Klaus Barbie, the vicious German SS captain, died in 1991, as is Nicu Ceaușescu, the Romanian leader who was killed by his own people. And Edward Said, one of the great American thinkers, Palestinian-American at Columbia University, who died in 2003, again much too early, added a great deal to our conversations about who we are as a people and what's going on in the Middle East. In 1690, the public occurrences, both foreign and domestic, spelt with CKs, by the way, interestingly enough, the first American newspaper ever to appear in what is now the United States, in the Americas, was published that day, on this day in 1690, for the first time and last time. But it was the beginning of newspapers in America. This is the day in 1789, the Bill of Rights were passed and became law in this nation. In 1789, the 12 Amendments were passed by the U.S. Constitution. This is the day in 1891. This is a very important day. And I'll just make this brief so we can get into our conversation. But it's a good, important piece of history. Between Reconstruction and Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 that instituted segregation, many African Americans around the country rose up and stood up fighting the end of Reconstruction and stood for their rights for many years, many being killed and murdered in that battle. There was an organization, a Farmers Union in America, that fought for the rights of farmers throughout the country. And it was a black and white organization that was ultimately divided on race in the 1890s when the white folks in that group said they did not want to have the federal government coming in to help fight for rights in the South because it would lead back to Reconstruction. So it split the union. But there was this huge strike that took place in 1891 of black farmers and sharecroppers, cotton pickers. 15 people were killed. 15 African Americans were killed. One plantation owner was killed. It was a great rebellion we don't cover very much of farmers in America in 1891 trying to fight for their rights as sharecroppers. This took place in this day in 1891. 15 African Americans were killed, and one plantation manager and six others given lengthy sentences on this day. This is the day in 1957 that Minnie Jean Brown, Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Thelma Morshed, Melba Patillo, Gloria Ray, Terrence Roberts, Jeffrey Thomas, and Carlotta Wills integrated Little Rock High School on this day in 1957, with the 101st Airborne standing by to stop the interference of supremacist mobs at that moment. This is the day in 1959 that Salim Bandaranaike, who was Prime Minister of Sri Lanka, was assassinated by a Buddhist monk, beginning this war that they fought until just a few years ago. This is the day in 1963, the Great Maze prison escape took place in England. 38 Irish Republican prisoners, armed with handguns, hijacked a prison lorry and went into the prison and freed their comrades. It was the largest prison escape since World War II in British history. This is the day the Mars Observer went up in 1992, the probe of Mars. We can't seem to figure out how to get our NASA rolling these days, but this took place in 1992. And finally, this is the day that given our news today in our next segment. In 2009, that Barack Obama, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and the French President, Sarkozy, had a joint TV appearance saying that Iran was building a secret nuclear enrichment facility. And we'll look at what that means today later on the news. Now we're going to jump into what's happening in our world here in America today at this moment. And looking at the battles in Congress, the bill that took place in the House of Representatives by the Republican-led Congress that would strip all money from what people call Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, in the ongoing battle to pay for government and not to pay for government in the United States. What sequestration would mean? It looks at this moment because Ted Cruz, a Republican senator, has said he's going to filibuster, that it may not get back to the House of Representatives in time to cut a deal once that has been stripped out of the bill by the Senate, which means we may have sequestration and layoffs and government shutdowns. What will that mean, among many other things? We are joined here in studio by Adar Ayira, project manager of the in Baltimore of the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst in the Baltimore local, in the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a spoken word artist. Bob Somerby's in studio, editor of the Daily Howler, and Marta Mossberg, columnist, for the News Post. Marta?
No, I'm a syndicated columnist now.
Syndicated columnist. I thought that was changed. Syndicated columnist. Now around the country, and good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So here we are. People look around. This is gridlock in America, but there's very substantive things going on here. Very quickly, just get your analysis of what you see happening on the Hill, starting with you, Bob Somerby.
Well, I don't think anything's happening. I think there's a demonstration called a filibuster going on. My impression is that there's not going to be a shutdown, that things are going to proceed.
You think that will happen?
There will not be a shutdown.
You think there will not be?
I think everyone's trying to get out of the way of the train wreck at this point. That doesn't tell us what's going to happen with default down the road, but that's my impression. The Cruz is wrapping it up, and the Republican Party is wrapping it up, and they're looking for a polite way to get out of the way. And that we've just gone through our 600th recent performance of budget battles, and I've stopped listening. I mean, it's just there's no point in listening to this stuff until the last 3 days. It's just one silly pseudo fight after another, and it's been going on for several years, and it's just. It's a symptom of the complete polarization of our political and journalistic system.
Marta Mossberg, I know we hear what your dog thinks, but what do you think?
I know, I'm sorry.
I'm going to call that an ovation. I'm calling that a standing O.
One of the things that stands out to me today is that I don't think that what Ted Cruz is doing is silly, because the American people do not want Obamacare. A majority don't. So I think he's saying, listen to the American people. He's bypassing the Beltway. He's bypassing Congress, people in his own party. So I think what he's doing is worthwhile, even if it doesn't end up defunding Obamacare. I think what it does is show the amount of support he has within the nation for changing things. So whether or not it ends up delaying the individual mandate for a year or forcing Congress to accept all the Obamacare provisions, I don't think this was useless. I think it's important, and I think it will change the debate going forward.
Adar?
Well, I think that this whole argument really speaks to what our values are as a country and who is important or thought to be important and invested in and who is not. And when we talk about budget cuts, when we talk about the changes that sequestration would bring, what we're talking about is the effects on poor people, the effects on people of color. We're talking about real people. We're just not talking about policies. We're talking, and we have to face how policies affect people. And that is the conversation that we do not seem to be having.
Can I jump in with one thing about what Marta said? I agree that what Cruz is doing is not necessarily silly. There's a letter to the editor of the New York Times this morning, which echoed a thought I've had quite a bit recently, which says basically, wouldn't progressives love it if we had progressive senators who were creating tantrums, call it what you want to call it, who were creating such a firestorm about progressive beliefs. Now, I think Cruz's policy views, they're not my policy views, but as a progressive, I'd love to see United States senators. We loved it when Bernie Sanders staged a 13-hour, I don't even remember what he was filibustering or pretending to filibuster. We loved that. And if there was
Who
a little
that?
Well, I mean, the liberal blogosphere loved that. If there was a little more fight from progressives, I think that would be a desirable thing.
Well, I think there was earlier this year when you look at what happened with Wendy Davis in Texas. But
right, and liberals love that.
Right. But, you know, I mean, to go back to, you know, to the poor people point that Adar brought up, I think that even when you factor in all the subsidies with Obamacare, it's still going to be a lot more expensive for people across the board. I mean, there will be certain people who are going to benefit, older people and people with certain health conditions. But this is, I mean, these rate increases are going to hurt everyone. This is not a high, you know, upper class, lower class. Pretty much everyone making over $25,000 is going to have a huge problem.
Well, I want to ask both of you some both things directly that the two of you have just said, Marta and Bob. But are you about to say what?
No, go, we can move. We can move on.
Well, one, that it's kind of a challenge to both of you. What the two things you both said, Martin. I looked at it before we went on the air, and again now I'm just looking at all the polls, and you know it's a way you can read polls any way you want to. But the polls also said people are skeptical about Obamacare in America. There's no question about the Affordable Health Care Act for lots of reasons. We can talk about those in a moment. But the polls also said that the majority of Americans do not think you should shut the government down over the Affordable Health Care Act, mm-hmm. overwhelmingly. And even the majority of Republicans don't think you should do that in most of these polls that were taken, whether it's the National Journal poll or the CNN poll, Pew Research poll. They've all kind of indicated that at some level or another. Some of the numbers are a little different. A good 17-20% in those polls said they would blame both parties. One poll said 37% of people would blame the Republicans and 30% would blame the Democrats. But it's clear that people don't want a shutdown. They don't want government stalled. That's the issue, I think, when you're talking about Cruz, Ted Cruz, not what people really think about the Affordable Health Care Act, Marta.
Right. But, I mean, I don't even think that he necessarily thinks what he's doing is going to stop or defund Obamacare. I mean, Harry Reid's basically said, you know, I'm not doing anything unless it funds all of the government. So I think, again, what he's doing is saying, listen to the American people, and he's going to be a force to be reckoned with going forward. So however this plays itself out, you know, whether it means that, you know, the individual mandate is going to be delayed or some other compromise will be reached, I doubt that the government will shut down as a result of this.
Yeah, I mean, shutting down the government is just, it makes no sense. No one could think it makes, unless you think that Obamacare is going to destroy the nation in the next 2 weeks, it just doesn't make sense ever to shut down the government. If you don't like Obamacare, as Republicans don't, there's a way to repeal it, which is you have to get people elected to an appropriate number of offices, and that's the way the system works. And I think most Republican leadership, certainly in the Senate, understands this, and I think Cruz is backing away from the whole shutdown threat also.
I would just say this. I mean, again, I want to get back to the point of whose voices are being heard in this discussion. Most of the people who have the loudest voices in this discussion already have health care, and very good health care at that. There are items offered by this act. We call it Obamacare, but it really is the Affordable Health Care Act. And when we talk about the fact that there are provisions in this act that will allow children to be on their parents' insurance until the age 25, so there will be Americans who have greater access or more access to health care insurance. When we talk about the projection that there are changes that will bring down the cost of health care or the cost of insurance in some states. We'll see whether that plays out or not, but it's not just a blanket, this is going to raise the rates for everybody. when I go into neighborhoods and when I'm listening to people talking, people want to give this a try. Those voices are not being heard. Those voices are poor. Those voices are majority of color. And those voices are not the voices that have a lot of options, as a lot of people do. So, again, it gets back to my point of who we are valuing in these discussions and who has voice in these discussions. And a lot of times it is not the people who have the capacity to have expanded options or benefits.
Mark Nugent, I want to welcome you to the conversation. I see you're here with us now. Mark Nugent is chief of the founders, one of the founders of Red Maryland, and a Maryland State editor for Watchdog Wire. Mark, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And Bob, a little pushback a little bit. When you were talking about you'd like to see progressives stand up just like Ted Cruz is standing up on some levels. Well, and but earlier, though, you talked about gridlock, and you talked about how Washington, D.C. can't get off a dime. So,
I wouldn't like to see progressives attempt to shut down the government over something that they should be proceeding toward another way. But I would like the fact that someone is standing. I think his policy views are ridiculous. But I think progressives should focus on the merits of the case more than on the loathing of the individual. And I think progressives would like it if there were more aggressive voices aggressively presenting the progressive point of view, which I would not want to see yelling, "We're going to shut down the government." I would want to see looking for ways to explain to people in the middle and on the right that they're being misled in various ways and that, that they might be better served by coming to understand that. But I'd like to see a little more fight from progressives. Now, I will say this, 30 million people are going to get health coverage out of the Affordable Care Act. So that strikes me as a good thing.
Let me go to the phones, and then we'll go right to Mark Nugent, and I want to come back to what Adar Ayira raised about whose voices are not heard and affected by these policies, given another vote that took place in Congress. And your thoughts here, 410-319-8888. Russ in East Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ. Welcome.
As I said to your call taker, I don't think Cruz is just being silly. I think he's morally wrong. United States senators ought to be about the business of obeying the law and encouraging others to do the same. And let's be reminded, Obamacare is the law. There are legitimate ways to do what they're trying to do, and I would support those efforts. But I don't think the majority of people are against Obamacare solely because I think there are more people who are poor and will benefit from this than wealthy people. So I think if you talk to people that are without insurance today and get their opinion as opposed to those people who are on the other end of the spectrum, I think you'll find more support. And let me finish, Mark, by saying this. We had the same internecine bloodletting during Bush's attempt to put through, or not Bush's putting through the Part D Medicare. But the Democrats didn't turn around and try to blow up the system. They fought against it tooth and nail, yeah. But they didn't talk about defunding and shutting down the government and doing all of these other morally reprehensible things that I'm hearing today. So I think we need to take a look at these fights, how we have these fights, and put some parameters in there that don't make us look like schoolyard children unable to come to any reasonable conclusions about anything. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much. Let me go, Mark Nugent, we haven't heard from you. Why don't you respond to what Russ was saying?
Well, first of all, I would say that the Democrats did actually undo parts of Medicare Part D when Obamacare got rid of the donut hole, which actually turned out to be one of the major cost-saving parts of the prescription drug benefit. But look, I mean, to say Cruz is morally wrong, look, he's a senator who believes in a law that doesn't believe in the law that's been passed, and he was elected there to try to repeal it. Now, look, I happen to think that, I don't think anything is going to come of this like anybody else here does. And the fact is that the real fight over Obamacare happens not in September 2013, but in November 2014 and November 2016. But in terms of Adara's point about, I have to say, look, these are raising costs on real families here. And if you're and that access to insurance is not the same thing as access to health care. Health insurance just gets you put in a line, in a waiting list, on a line for many things. If you really, the problem with the current pre-Obamacare system was that it was larded with subsidies, mandates, and all kinds of things like that. What Obamacare does is lard even more of those on top of it, and it doesn't actually get to what can really help people, which is a patient-centered free market system where you have actual choice. Obamacare restricts your choices. And it's also, too, you know, you're seeing doctors leaving the profession because they can't afford, they're not going to be paid back the rates, the rate-setting measures. Look, in Maryland, we have 66 individual mandates on what health insurance companies must offer. And what that does is limit the competition. That's why we have two companies that dominate the small group and individual market. People want their choice and what kind of what their plans offer. Not everyone wants these huge Cadillac plans. Some people want a plan that gives them a certain amount of things. Some people want more. But we have no choice to choose that. And Adar, another point you're making about who has a voice and these budget cuts, right? Well, if you remember the SNAP bill that the House Republicans passed, and the hem and hawing and the hue and cry that it was Senator Cardin said it was going to gut SNAP. What actually it does, it increases SNAP spending 57% over the next 10 years.
It cuts $39 billion out and 4 million people.
Yes, but it still increases money over the next. It's a 57.
But it cuts $39 billion out and takes 4 million people off without the ability to get SNAP. I mean, I think we're playing with words here.
That's not gutting it. I don't know how a 57% increase in spending. It's a 57% increase. It's not. They're defining as a cut, not increasing the spending amount that they wanted. A cut to the increase is not a cut. It's still an increase. And that's we have to be honest about in our discussion.
Well, I think
about
does. But this is the word game that Republicans play and Democrats play that that fudges reality. You're taking $39 billion out of SNAP. Mm-hmm. 4 million Americans, more than 4 million Americans, will no longer be able to get food stamps to pay for food. That's the reality.
But also, how much of that is duplicative and wait? We had look here in Baltimore. We had the food stamp fraud. How much are we putting out in waste, fraud, and abuse?
You know, Mark, one word that you said really sums it up, and that is game. We can talk about this food stamp fraud, quote unquote, which people put out as being the rule instead of the exception. We can talk about what money is going to be saved. And anyone who knows me knows as cheap as I am, I'm off of saving money. But again, those conversations obscure the fact that people who are already on the edge, who have no free market options because they have no money, will lose. It obscures the fact that there are plenty of middle income people who still cannot afford insurance for themselves and their families, who with one illness will be put over the edge in terms of their not only their physical health, their physical health, but their financial health. And those are the types of conversations that are not happening.
So we have to take a short break. And we come back, I'll let you jump right back, Marta. I heard you jumping in. I'll let you come back, and then the guests will respond. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. As I said, this is the birthday of Cecil Womack. And we go out a little bit for this break with Womack and Womack's Love Wars. Stay with us.
All this pain in my heart. I remember losing my head and calling you pain. The light dirty me.
Welcome back. That was the great Glenn Gould, who passed away on this day playing the Bach variations, just still amazing to hear it after all these years. I want to remind you that WEAA begins its fall membership drive October 12th, runs through October 20th, and we need pledge room volunteers for this program, other programs, so please join us. Call 443-885-2000. 2075. That's 443-885-2075. Or just log on to weaa.org and be a volunteer. Come on and join us here. Have some fun. Help us raise money for the best public radio station in town and be part of that. So we are here with Mark Nugent, one of the founders of Red Maryland, Maryland State Editor for Watchdog Wire, Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, Adar Ayira, project manager of the More in the Middle initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a spoken word artist, and nationally syndicated columnist Marta Mossberg. And you all at 410-319-8888. We'll come to your call in a minute. Jessica, you're the next caller up. Just hold on. We're going to, because I promised to go right to Marta to have a her response to what Adar just said. Marta?
Thanks, Mark. I wanted to go back to what Adar was saying. I mean, she's making this moral argument for Obamacare, but, you know, this is something that has huge economic consequences, and particularly on the young. I mean, you have to remember that two-thirds of the uninsured are under the age of 40. And so in order for Obamacare to work, they have to sign up. If they're willing to pay more, and it's, in some cases it's going to be over 200% more, that's going to be really tough. I don't see how that's moral for them, how that helps them, how that's fair in any sense of the term. So, you know, you can't talk about this as only, you know, it's going to help some people, but it has huge consequences on the whole nation. So, you know, you can't talk about certain people in isolation. This is a very expensive program that is not increasing access, like Mark said. It's really giving more insurance without making it easier for people to choose their doctors, to be able to afford insurance, to be able to fully benefit from this program.
It was actually Bob who said it increases, not Mark. It just increases the access to health care.
No, it creates, it creates more access to health care, but not more health care.
What I would say about the way it helps younger people is it's the same way Social Security helps younger people. You pay in when you're younger, and you're part of the system when you're older. It's a generational agreement that extends over the decades and the centuries. And, you know, that's the idea of everyone paying into a healthcare system is that you pay in your whole life, and you may be paying in when you're younger, and you may not need as much health care, although you may. You never know. But then when you're older, then you're part of the system, and younger people are paying in to help you then. That's just the whole – but that's that
but
only
that
makes
sense if Social Security was solvent, which it's not going to be very soon. So I don't know how you can make that argument about health care if it's – you know, it's busting the bank here and Social Security. We can't even afford Social Security.
We can afford Social Security very nicely. I really thought those arguments had gone away. But this is the whole – this is an argument that only makes sense in a nation that sees itself as a nation, not in a set of warring tribes. And we're increasingly becoming a set of warring tribes, and nothing makes sense in a nation which sees itself as a set of warring tribes. That's a big problem we're facing.
Let me go to Adar before we go back to
– Thank you, because I want to make clear that whether we have the Affordable Care Act or not, there are huge implications for the nation. I am not here arguing for or against the Affordable Care Act. What I am here doing and what Associated Black Charities does is we look at the impact of policies on people and on the economic vitality of our community. That's what we do, and particularly as these policies affect people of color and African Americans in this state. As you all know, we are a statewide organization.
And Mark, before we go to the phones, jump in.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry. I wanted to add in something. Like, we got to talk about – we're talking about Obamacare and health care entitlement spending, Social Security, and the overall arc of fiscal sustainability for the nation. And I was flipping through the CBO, the latest CBO report, and that they said that health care entitlement spending by 2038 – that's just 25 years away – is going to reach 14% of GDP. Now, I want to put that number in context. The average federal revenues of as a percentage of GDP since World War II has been 18%. By 2038, that's healthcare spending is going to be 14% of what the federal government brings in. Now, that's serious unsustainability for me. Now, the CBO does say that revenues are going to jump up to about 19% of GDP. But that still, to me, is we only have 5% of GDP left over for the rest of government spending, for everything else, defense,
health, research, everything else, roads, transportation, infrastructure, all that stuff. We have a serious health care entitlement spending problem. And what the number, the revenue numbers also tell you is that it's not a matter of low taxation. It's a matter of we spend too much. We have to seriously find a way. And Bob, this goes to your point about political polarization over this, is because these fixes are very, very politically unpopular for both sides. Neither Democrat or Republican that I can find is going to say, yeah, I want to really slash health care entitlement spending to get it under, 8% of GDP. I mean, those are serious, serious issues, and these are the things that have to be done. And we have a political structure that's unwilling to do that. And I'm saying this from an ideological perspective, not a partisan perspective. I'm a Republican, but I can show you plenty of Republicans that if you tell them, you show them the numbers and tell them what they have to cut, they balk in a second.
Bob, then I'll open the phones here.
Here's a good point of potential agreement. We've discussed many times in this show that our health care spending in this country per person is ludicrously out of line with every other developed nation. Money is disappearing out of our – this has something to do with Obamacare. This is pre-Obamacare. Money has been disappearing out of our health care system in gigantic amounts for a long time. And this is – there's no question. We have a giant national problem with our health care spending. And as it's often been said by economist Dean Baker, for example, that if the United States per person healthcare spending magically overnight was changed to that of France, which has an excellent healthcare system, the federal deficit would be a surplus tomorrow, because a great deal of health spending is government spending. So there's no question we have a gigantic problem with the volume of healthcare spending. Pre-Obamacare, this has nothing to do with Obamacare.
Sure, and I would agree with that to the point if I can say it. And the reason why that is because we have no idea how much things actually cost. There is no price mechanism in our system because it's a third-party payer system. Look, if I'm you have a product, and as the consumer, I don't care how much it costs because I don't know the true cost, and I'm the producer, and I don't care because I know somebody else is subsidizing the cost. I have no incentive to lower the price to make it competitive. We have, and that's the problem with Obamacare, is, as I said earlier, is that it actually lards more the subsidies and mandates onto the current system. There's no real price mechanism here.
And of course, if we looked at this, what we keep calling Obamacare.
That's what they call it now, Mark. Obama calls it Obamacare.
You call it whatever you like. That the show we did here, I guess it was months and months back, but when you looked at the Affordable Health Care Act that we have today and the Republican proposals that were on the table when President Clinton was trying to reform health care, they're almost the same bill.
Nixon proposed a national health care system.
No, his was different.
If you want to go that far back.
His was different, as was the one that was proposed in 1948, which were closer to single payer systems that were like Medicare for all. They were very different than what's been proposed by Republicans or Democrats since the 1990s. But yeah, you're right.
The concept of having care for everyone or universal care started a long time ago.
So unlike the days when my dad was a doctor in the 50s and 60s, when he would take his little medical bag and walking to housing projects anywhere else just to deliver health care, those days are gone. 410-319-8888, money or no money. Jessica, you're on the air.
Oh, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. I was calling because I'm kind of calling from the standpoint of just the average working middle-class mom. Me and my fiance, we both work for the fire department, and we're not rich. It's like we could go down and we could ask for assistance and we can ask for help and we could do all those things. But we know that we could also make sacrifices and change the way we live a little bit and also leave that money available for people who really need it. However, people have to realize in these programs, I feel like people don't really do the work to weed out what's going wrong in them. You have a whole lot of money thrown onto a people and say, okay, go do this. Here's the money to do that. But they don't really educate people. Like, for example, the SNAP program. Yeah, you're getting $900 a month in food stamps, but if you have no idea about nutrition, it's just a sliding scale because you're going to buy what's cheap. You're going to buy cookies and ravioli and cans, and it's going to be bad for your children, and they're going to get sick, and so are you. And now the medical care costs go up because you're going to the doctor. Like, we don't teach about wellness. We don't teach about prevention. We throw drugs at people, and we throw money at people, and then when the stuff's failing, nobody understands why. And I just feel like people need to be more educated, spend a little bit of time and effort on education and on, instead of punishing everyone why not we take the time and the money to weed out, well, okay, this young lady was getting help 3 years ago. Now it's 2 years later and she's got five more kids. Maybe it's time to cut her back a little bit.
Darwin's respond. Let me just say also that the number is off. Nobody gets $900 a month in food stamps. In Baltimore, in Maryland, the average is $128. In California, it's $150 a month. So nobody gets $900 a month in food stamps. If that was the case, I would apply for food stamps. But not,
not about Whole Foods.
Yeah, right. Really, go to Whole Foods. And the other part is that there's a real mythology about people having babies, and actually that's declining, not increasing in America. But Adar.
You know, I agree with the caller that there needs to be more more focus on wellness, on overall wellness. But if we're going to focus on overall wellness, we also have to focus on the extenuating factors in people's lives. It is very easy to say people need to buy more fruit and vegetables. When you look at the cost of fruit and vegetables as opposed to the cost of those processed, cheap foods that will feed a family of four and that will stretch, then you begin to see why people make some of the choices they do. If we're talking about communities where there are food deserts, you can begin to see why people make the choice that they do. If we are talking about people going to the corner store and buying whatever is there, or them taking four buses and making a four-hour round trip to the store and then only being able to carry or to buy what they can carry on the bus, you begin to see why people make the choices they make. This is not to alleviate the individual responsibility that people have, but it is to expand that so that we can also look at those societal and structural and landscape realities in which people live. So it's not just about getting more educated on nutrition, on wellness, or anything. It is about us as a country looking at the conditions that enable and encourage certain choices that people make that then we all as a society have to pay for.
Marta, and then let's go back to let's move to the subject. Were you about to say something, or was that Mark?
No,
I'm sorry.
I was just thinking about the huge fight to to prevent Walmart from moving into Remington. I mean, talk about food deserts. Well, I mean, that would have stopped. So, I mean, and I think it is going forward now. But I mean, I think that society should make it easier for companies that provide food cheaply and large access to it. Make that easier to get to, not harder, which is what Baltimore has done.
And we also should encourage work with living wage. And there are a lot of things that we should do, and that if we were really looking at things not just from a political perspective, but in terms of what would benefit society as a whole generationally, then maybe we would make different choices.
Well, to one point on that living wage issue, I mean, Baltimore was the first city in the nation, I think, to enact a living wage bill. I mean, where is Baltimore right now? I mean, that in and of itself does nothing. I think it's just a symbolic act that actually hurts people rather than helps them. I mean, Maryland, Baltimore in particular, needs to focus on creating a climate where people can actually find jobs. And that's not the case here. I mean, we keep losing people, losing businesses.
And I agree with you that we definitely need to invest in businesses and in people. We do not have conversations that face the reality or that even acknowledge the reality, the structural reality of people trying to get jobs, how people are profiled because of neighborhoods, how we do not fund workforce training programs, how there is a misalignment between where jobs actually are and where people live, and no transportation to match the people with the jobs. There is a whole host of things which fuel this that we choose as a society not to look at, not see, and not address.
So, Mark, I'll let you jump right back in, Mark, and get folks in here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. The Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, just put out a statement saying that by October 17th, the Treasury will only have $60 billion to pay any debts or any bills for the – $30 billion, excuse me, to pay the nation's bills, he just said, literally just a few minutes ago, and that no one's talking about dealing with a $16.7 billion debt limit, the debt in the nation. And so – So the question is, how real is that? And it seems like nobody's really kind of wrestling with how to address that. We're always playing at the fringes here. Nobody's, whether you take the conservative answer or progressive answer from the left or anybody else's answer to how to address that, nobody is really talking about that on Capitol Hill. Nobody.
That's the next kabuki theater. You mean the raising the debt limit?
Right.
Yeah, that's the next charade we're going to go through. And presumably the debt limit is going to be raised at some point. It would. That's a much more serious, potentially much more serious matter than shutting down the government for how many days, which would be bad enough. The debt limit is more serious. But this is, again, just the series of budget fights we've been having for the last several years. And so we're going through the same steps we went through the last time.
Mark, you're about to say what?
Sure. One thing, and just to jump back to what Adar was saying, I would say also, too, another thing you want to address is how the state's number one school system also fails its most vulnerable students, being last eighth grade in math, eighth grade math poverty gap, and 38th in fourth grade reading poverty gap. I would just put that in there too. But to the point about the debt limit is that, look, again, this is another one of those political questions, or the answers are too hard for our politicians to take because no one wants to make those hard choices. But the CBO says our debt service is going to reach 100% of GDP by 2038 again. Look, that's unsustainable. That's you're talking follow the Roman Empire. Yes, agreed. Exactly, Marta. That's the problem. But the problem is that you keep increasing the debt limit, right? You're going in farther and farther into debt. Obama's own budget proposal, which came out in the spring, increases the debt $5.2 trillion over the next 10 years again. It's the old saying, if you want to get out of a ditch, you got to start digging. And this goes back to the healthcare entitlement spending. All this deficit funded spending goes to funnel into the our entitlement spending, which is the elephant and the gorilla in the room. And no one wants to make the hard political choices. It's coming to the point where if we don't make the decisions, the bond markets are. You're going to have to make these cuts. You're going to have to find another way to deliver these benefits or to give folks more control of their own money to make these healthcare decisions for themselves. And still, Adar, I would say this too, that is, I'm not against an entitlement state, but we need to make the safety net a true safety net for the most vulnerable, not increasingly expand the access to this to the middle class folks, and to solve that problem, you need to make healthcare and health insurance more affordable by getting government out of the business of subsidizing it, and to allow more competition and more price mechanisms, so you can get lower prices for the middle class, so they can afford healthcare. It's a big pie, obviously, but like I said, the hard decisions need to be made, and I don't think our political class now can make them.
I agree that we need to make health care. There are a lot of things that we need to make more affordable so that people can truly have options and truly have access. That is what is lacking. Were those things affordable before Obamacare? For many families, no, they weren't. So to say that things will be worse after Obamacare, as if they were just so great before, that's not true for many families across the country who are middle class and who still have not been able to afford health care or insurance, and for poor families who are in that same boat with even less options.
Well, I would say the reason why, and especially in the state of Maryland, is, as my point before, is that government has mandated what insurance companies must offer, and they're mandating products and services that a lot of middle-class families don't want. They want to have a choice in what their insurance covers, and they can't have that. They have to pay for all these other things that are mandated because the insurance companies can go lobby for their services to be added in. That's why you only have two companies that dominate in the state of Maryland, that dominate the small group and insurance market. It's because there's no competition, because the other companies that offer...
Mark, I get them balanced out of the conversation here. Dar was trying to say something, so was Bob, and I'm going to get back to Marta.
I would just say, I invite anyone to come out to meetings with me, to communities, and to listen to what I hear. And what we at Associated Black Charities, what we do is try to expand the lens, because we have conversations looking at the data and the information that we know, but once again, that leaves out the expanse of experience of so many people without the access and without the opportunity to share their realities. And it's those realities which should and can inform public policy so that what we get is better public policy.
And, well, and also the point of view is not on this air today, which is usually on this air pretty vociferously when we have these debates about where the future of the healthcare system, whether it's the greater marketplace or Affordable Health Care Act, is many of those who think that the answer is Medicare for all. That is a single-payer system that is a pass-through, and then and also have a watchdog agency to watch the cost of healthcare. Bob,
I think the answer is free root beer from the drinking fountains. The reason why Medicare for all is not, it's, you know, I'm not opposed to that. I think that's, you know, there's many of the societies that have superb healthcare systems operating at less than half of what we spend have versions of Medicare for all. And, you know, France, good. But that's just not within the realm of what's imaginable within our political system, and you saw that from what President Obama did with Obamacare, what he proposed as a candidate, what Hillary Clinton proposed as a candidate. The only person who proposed anything like Medicare for all was Dennis Kucinich, and he proposed it because he knew he wasn't running for president; he was running, you know, to have a platform. So it's just not even imaginable within our journalistic and political structure. Well, that we're ever going to have Medicare for all. And if we did, we'd still be paying twice as much as everybody else, because the overspending is going on within all aspects of our health care.
Right. The cost of health care is beyond the system you have. It's,
right,
we're not controlling anything in this country. But I think we don't – I think, well, Marty, one of the lessons that I think progressives can learn from conservatives, or at least the people that have kind of surged into Congress, is that if you only accept what is inevitable, then nothing changes.
Right. I mean, what Cruz is doing.
Of course, you and I think it was inevitable to be different, but that's fine.
No, Cruz is not accepting the premise of the government as it exists today. I mean, what Mark was saying earlier about how both parties are unable to make those hard decisions, and Cruz is saying we have to, and the American people want us to, or at least a lot of us do, or a lot of Americans do, and that's who he's speaking to with his filibuster. And I think that I hope that more people feel like they have a voice in government as a result of what he's doing. On both sides of the aisle, I think that's how our representatives should respond to us, is not just say we have to do things the same old way. I mean, everything right now, I mean, when you have a government who is basically telling you, you know, it's called the Affordable Care Act, but the Health and Human Services basically just said, you know, it won't even compare costs on the what Obamacare is going to be, the three different plans, to what exists right now, because all they're saying is, you know, it's going to be cheaper than we thought it was. They know it's going to be more expensive. I mean, everyone's lying to you all over the place. You need to have people who speak the truth about what the real numbers are, and I think Cruz is trying to do that.
Well, let me go back to what you said, Mark, what I said at the start. I agree with you. I'll contradict myself now. I would like to see some progressive voice shouting very loudly, as Senator Cruz is shouting loudly in a direction that I don't agree with. I'd like to see a progressive voice shouting loudly in favor of the craziness of our health spending, the craziness of our system, and the desirability, let's say, of something like Medicare for all. And it might be impossible right now, as it basically is impossible right now, partly because every senator is funded by, health concerns. That's what I was talking about at the beginning. I'd like to see progressive voices yelling as loud as Senator Cruz is yelling for something I just don't agree with.
Well, I think there are. I think there are plenty of them right now.
No one's yelling for Medicare for all. That just doesn't – maybe Bernie Sanders sometimes.
Maybe a few others. There are a few people in the Congressional Black Caucus, not many.
I don't know.
Not many. Conyers.
Know. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You know, the voices are few and far between, and I think that's partially because what you just said, Bob, I think the money is so deeply entrenched both on both sides of the aisle by healthcare companies, insurance companies, hospital coalitions backing people for Congress and Senate, that whether you want a marketplace solution or whether you want the Affordable Health Care Act that most insurance companies want because they can make more money at it, everybody's being backed by somebody who's not doesn't want to get to the real issues. Other than screaming on the floor to stop Obamacare.
And that's – talk about speaking truth. That's truth that hardly ever gets spoken. Who is being backed by whom?
Well, I would say this. One of the biggest backers of Obamacare was the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. So, I mean,
both parties.
Yep. Yeah, and speaking truth on both sides of the aisle.
Sure. I'm not saying it's not, but let's look at here. This goes to a point I've been trying to make for quite a while, is big business loves big government. Look, you know, we act like regulation is used by government, progressive government, you know, crusaders to rein in big government, when in fact it's actually they work together, whereas big business gets out of it and decreased competition for their products. I would say General Electric is one of the biggest practitioners of that kind of rent-seeking. And that's why a more free market system where you don't have government tipping the scales one way or the other for insurance companies or pharma companies gets you to, in terms of the price mechanism, gets you to competition, lower prices, and more transparency in what our health care costs actually are.
I mean, Tim Carney, who writes for the Washington Examiner, I think he's one of the best writers as far as crony capitalism is concerned in the country. If you read him, you'll see the connections between government and big business, and it's horrible.
Let me just say, General Electric, that's the same General Electric that used to own NBC News until last year. Am I correct?
Yep.
So it's, you know, it runs through politics and through journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we are here at the end of this conversation. It's been a fascinating conversation today. I appreciate all of our guests for being part of this conversation. You just heard Bob Somerby, editor of the Daily Howler. Also in the studio are Dara Ayira, project manager of the Baltimore and the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion, and a spoken word artist, Marta Mossberg, nationally syndicated columnist, and Mark Nugent, one of the founders of Red Maryland and the Maryland State editor for Watchdog Wire. Thank the four of you so much for taking the time with our listeners today.
Thank you,
thanks.
Mark.
Thank you.
Take a brief break. We come back, look at the international side of the scale before we talk about breathing and your health at the end of next hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.